Tired of Trying to Measure Up, Chapter 4, When Shame is the Name of the Game. Mary's mother was ill and expected to die. As Mary and I talked in my church office one afternoon, she told me the painful story of how their relationship had broken down long ago. Mary's mother was an impeccably groomed, always punctual, and precise perfectionist who had virtually driven her daughter away from her through repeated embarrassments. They hadn't even spoken much for the past 15 years. Now, a phone call alerted Mary that her mother was flying in from another city for a visit, undoubtedly her last. "This is my big chance to reconcile with her," Mary said, wringing her hands. "But I'm all torn up inside. I'm confused, nervous, excited, terrified. What if she won't listen? What if she won't forgive me? What if I can't forgive her?" Mary's lifestyle was pretty laid back. Her house was small and modestly decorated. She dressed unpretentiously. But Mother was coming. Time to do something special. Since Mom was going to be there for 3 days, Mary had gone all out and bought 3 bright new dresses. She'd had a friend come over to help her perk up her house with fresh wall paint and new curtains. As Mary left my office, she was a nervous wreck. When Mary came in for her next counseling session, her mother had come and gone, and she gave me a glowing report. "Mom and I got along great. We said what we needed to say to each other. I feel like we're reconciled." Then, in the next breath, Mary broke down in tears. I was confused by the contradiction. When she'd composed herself a little, I asked, "Why are you crying?" She replied, "I still don't know if my mom loves and accepts me. I didn't show her the real me. She saw clothes and decorations I don't usually have. She liked those. But would she have been the same if I hadn't gone through all the extra stuff? All the external stuff? Would she have liked me?" Mary had done everything, quote-unquote, right. She had lived up to her mother's standard, whether real or imagined, and she had come out feeling unloved and unaccepted. What prevented Mary from feeling affirmed? I think the answer lies both in what happened and in what didn't happen in Mary's life. What did happen was that the wounding, shaming messages that were deeply ingrained in Mary's heart were not erased by one positive visit. In addition, some essential and non-negotiable needs were not met. Now she was experiencing the real message of the visit. "You're acceptable and good only because you've lived up to my standards." In Mary's case, she had been subjected to years of critical remarks long before she left home, followed by years of almost no contact because she failed to measure up. Not everyone has to experience such an exaggerated rejection in order to develop a shame-based identity. In fact, what might be an insignificant remark or action to one person can be devastating to another. Many factors come into play, including expectations, sensitivity, and even the context in which the rejection occurs. Jane, one of my former clients, is a very fine artist. During one session, she remembered a painful event that occurred almost 16 years before. At age 14, she had painted a picture and entered it into the county fair competition. Even though she was competing with many skilled adults, the judges awarded her the blue ribbon. When she brought the ribbon and picture home, her parents threw a party and invited family and friends. While the celebration was going on, however, her dad took her aside and, pointing to an object in the picture, said, "This is really a fine picture, Jane, but wouldn't it have been better if this here were in a different spot?" Through tears, she told me that when her father made that comment, she thought, "I'm finished with that picture. In fact, I'm sure the judges think I'm finished too. But I guess I could have done better." Remembering that event triggered a lot more memories for Jane about the messages she received in her family. All of them said that not only was she incapable of doing something good enough, she was incapable of knowing if something was good enough. This had devastating effects on her sensitive and naturally perceptive nature. What is a shame-based system? As we've already touched upon, a shame-based system can be a family, church, or group in which an individual is given the message that he is defective and inadequate as a human being. Eventually, he becomes ingrained with a deep sense of disgrace. By God's design, the primary channel for learning one's identity, for having needs met, for understanding who God is, and for developing relationships is the family. In order to prevent shame from being passed through us to future generations, we must recognize the shame-producing characteristics of unhealthy relationship systems. The following is a list of 10 characteristics that best describe the relationship systems, past and or present, under which tired, wounded people labor. Numbered 1 to 10. 1. Out loud shaming. 2. Shame-based systems are performance-oriented. 3. Unspoken rules govern shame-based systems. 4. People in shame-based systems code when they talk. 5. Shame-based families are idolatrous. 6. Shame-based systems have a hard time with kids. 7. They are preoccupied with fault and blame. 8. Shame-based systems are strong on head skills. 9. They are weak on heart skills. And 10. People in shame-based systems only look as if their needs are met. Back to number 1. Out loud shaming. While all shame-based systems shame people, the first is the only one that refers to overt shaming, out loud shaming. Comparing one person to another causes shame. Name-calling causes shame. Phrases like, "What's wrong with you?" and "What an idiot you are," will shame a person. So does raising the standard after a task is completed, saying, "Well, you did that well enough, but you didn't do... dot, dot, dot. You didn't measure up." The following characteristics will show how shame is transmitted in silent or more subtle ways. And because the shaming occurs covertly or undercover, it is often harder to confront, untangle, and overcome. Number 2, shame-based systems are performance-oriented. We all need an environment where we feel our needs are met because of who we are and not because of what we do. In shame-based relationships, value and acceptance are earned on the basis of performance. Performance, however, always seems to fall short of the standard, giving us the message, "You are defective and inadequate." Eventually, we become ingrained with a need to measure up. What follows is more impotent performance, which generates even more shame. And on it goes. Unfortunately, we can also see this pattern in the relationship many Christians have with God. Never before have there been so many how-to seminars and books on everything from prayer to potty training, it seems, in which Christians are told they will find the key to closeness with God. And never before have so many spiritually tired Christians been wounded and in need of counseling. Trying hard is not the solution. When someone becomes a Christian, he has a brand new identity as a child of God because of the cross of Christ. But the truth is, people are affirmed in our society, in families, and even in our churches for what they do, not for who they are. When a person comes into a relationship with Christ, most of the teaching he receives is about how Christians are supposed to act, not who a Christian is as a new creation in Christ. Likewise, most parents get a sense of value from the performance of their kids, and husbands and wives draw a sense of value from the capabilities, career, and attentiveness of their spouse. Being a good Christian husband, wife, parent, and kid. What is it that makes us acceptable, valuable people? We are often taught that acceptability comes from useful religious performance that lives up to the expectation of our particular religious community. And since human performance is an inadequate, false means to acquire value, it always falls short. Someone is always displeased, and even if he isn't dissatisfied, we are. We simply can't act perfectly enough. Number three, unspoken rules govern shame-based systems. The rules that reign supreme in shame-based relationships are seldom, if ever, spoken out loud. In fact, the only time you can be sure that an unspoken rule is there is if you break it. Two specific unspoken rules that are more damaging than any others are these: can't talk and can't win. The can't talk rule is easy to understand. It goes something like this. There really aren't any problems here. If you think there is a problem, you are the problem. The truth of the matter is that some parents in a family system and some pastors in a church system are threatened, afraid of what the existence of a problem says about them as human beings and leaders. In other words, if there is a problem or even a question, then the person raising the issue must be challenging them. No matter how gently the question was raised, when the question is raised at all, you become the issue in a shame-based system. It's as if naming a problem out loud caused the problem to exist, which of course is not true. Individuals in this kind of system learn not to bring up a problem or question for fear of making waves. The can't talk rule is given in shame-based relationships for three reasons. First, if my value and acceptance are earned by my performance, then any lapse in performance shames me and can't be talked about. Secondly, if a lapse in my performance can't be covered up, then I must project the blame away from myself so I can avoid being shamed. Therefore, if you confront me, I'll blame you for making a big deal out of nothing or for being oversensitive. Francine's story illustrates how this works. Francine was being physically abused by her husband. Through the encouragement of friends, she decided to report the abuse to authorities. Her husband was arrested and put in jail. I might ask, why did Francine's husband go to jail? And many people might answer, because Francine called the police. The truth is, he went to jail because he was abusing Francine. He broke the law. Beating your wife is illegal in all 50 states. However, the message given to Francine by her husband and echoed by his family and even their pastor was this: you are disloyal, unforgiving, and unsubmissive. You overreacted. The unspoken message was, being beaten by someone is not the problem. The problem is that you weren't strong enough to take a few slaps, punches, and kicks without crying like a baby. When victims believe that message, they don't call the police. And when they don't call the police, the abuse continues. But the truth is, it was perfectly right for Francine to hold her husband accountable for his behavior. The can't talk rule has yet a third function. In order for all the unspoken rules to have power to control people's lives, they must remain unspoken. Can't talk keeps them that way. The can't win rule is really two contradictory rules combined into one. Here are just a few examples. Always tell the truth, But when you go to Grandma's, don't tell her you hate her bread stuffing. If she asks, just be polite, eat it, and say you like it. Honesty is the best policy, but if so-and-so calls, tell them I'm not here. Don't keep anything from your parents, but mother or father would be so upset if she knew about this, so please don't tell them. The problem is that if a person acts on one rule, he is shamed for failing at the other. No performance is good enough. And since performance is the issue, shame is the result. Here are some other examples of unspoken rules that govern shame-based systems. Unless recognized and purposefully rejected, members of the system will apply them in their future relationships without even being aware of it. What's real doesn't matter. How things look is what matters. What other people think is most important. Adults are more important than children. Adults always know what children need, feel, and want better than children. People who feel sad are oversensitive. Something is wrong with people who feel at all. Feelings don't matter. Certain feelings are wrong. Not showing feelings is the same as not having them. If parents are upset, the behavior of their kids is the cause. If parents are upset, the behavior of their kids is the solution. It's okay for parents to act inappropriately in order to get their kids to act appropriately. There's a different set of ethical and moral rules for adults than there is for kids. It's better to be seen and not heard. Kids have to act 15 years older than they really are. If you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. We can solve all of our problems ourselves. We don't have any problems. Questioning is disrespectful. It's never okay to say no to an adult. Women are here to do what men want. There's a different set of rules for men than there is for women. When men are upset, you'd better take them seriously. When women are upset, it must be their time of the month, or they're just being oversensitive. You know how women are. God helps those who help themselves. Peace at all costs. It's not okay to have needs. Needs are selfish. The list really goes on and on. While they remain unspoken, they have power to control. When they are said out loud, they look as inappropriate and shaming as they are. Some of you reading the above list may have begun to feel guilty for letting yourself admit that your families actually treated you that way. Actually, it isn't guilt. The can't-talk rule shames anyone who brings the unspoken rules into the light. Left in the dark, the rules have an incredible amount of power. One last thought on the power of unwritten rules. In a shame-based system, these rules have more power than written ones. For example, the Bible says in Ephesians 4:25, "Therefore, putting away falsehood, let everyone speak the truth with his neighbor." The written rule then is be honest. The unwritten rule is be nice. Even in families and churches that profess to care a lot about what the Bible says, many times the unwritten rule prevails. Which rule won in your family? Number 4, people in shame-based systems code when they talk. Growing up with can't talk, can't win, and other unspoken rules creates the need to code what you say. For instance, many people I've talked with were raised with an unspoken rule that says favors aren't optional. That means when mom or dad says, "Would you do me a favor?" that meant do it. You didn't have an option to say no. It wasn't a favor after all. It was a command. But it sounded nicer to call it a favor. However, a non-optional favor is confusing. It's a contradiction. Parents say no to your favors, right? On top of that, if you notice the unspoken rule and said it out loud, it seems as if favors aren't optional in this family, or it feels as if adults are more important than kids, then you were shamed for being disrespectful to adults. You became the problem. It very swiftly becomes clear that needs, honest feelings, questions, and opinions that differ are not okay. Therefore, people have to learn to get what they need or let out what's inside by putting it in code. Saying things straight gets you labeled as the problem. In shame-based families and churches, members have invisible code books that they carry in their heads, though most of them are unaware they are doing so. The code book is an absolute essential if you are to survive in a shame-based system. It helps you to code things you want to say to others with the least amount of waves possible. It helps you to understand what others are saying so that you can use the necessary shame-avoiding behavior. It teaches you very unhealthy communication patterns, and it keeps people apart. Let me show you how this works. My dad collected HO scale electric trains. One day during a visit to his house, he and I were having a conversation on the sofa downstairs. From the upstairs bedroom, we heard Aaron, who was then 3, playing with a bellows train whistle. One of the ways my dad coded was to talk to the air. It was an unintentional habit. When he heard the sound of his whistle, he looked off in the distance and said, "Yep, that's a $40 whistle. Hope she doesn't break it." Having grown up with my dad's code, I knew what to do. I had my code book section on decoding air talk memorized. I knew that what he really meant to say was, "Go get my expensive whistle away from your daughter." How about this one? "It sure would be nice if somebody around here would take out the garbage." "Read your code book." "That really means you're supposed to do it." "What if you ignore the code?" "Boy, I can't get any of these lazy people around here to take out the garbage." "Read your code book. That means shame on you. You're supposed to take out the garbage." What's a good enough reason to take out the garbage? Because it's full. In shame-based families, people take out the garbage to protect themselves from being shamed, or in response to the hot poker-like message that we are lazy creatures if we don't. Was my father unreasonable for wanting to make sure his whistle didn't get broken? No. Was he incapable of protecting his own whistle? No. Was my daughter so ferocious that he would have gotten hurt if he tried to approach her? No. Was it my job to get in the middle of their relationship and make it turn out all right? No. Who was responsible for the relationship between my father and my daughter? For people to be close, they need to have direct relationships with each other, not through someone else. Many people expend a lot of energy propping up weak relationships, trying to make everyone believe they are good ones. Triangling. This brings me to another unhealthy aspect about coding called triangling. Triangular relationships are an issue in most every family I counsel. Dad wants child to clean out the garbage. Dad tells mom. Mom codes it to make it less hurtful. She tells child, "It would be nice if you'd clean out the garbage." Child ignores the coded message or promises to do it later. Mom codes the child's response to make it more palatable. She tells dad, "He misunderstood. Don't be upset." Who do you think gets tired in this triangle? Not long after my dad died, I looked at my mom one day and realized that I didn't know her very well. Various things contributed to this, But one of them was the fact that the focus of our relationship all too often was my father. Much of the energy in our relationship was spent on decoding messages and trying not to upset Dad. But now the focal point of our relationship for 29 years, my dad, was gone. Consequently, the relationship between my mother and me suddenly looked as neglected as it truly was. 5. Shame-based families are idolatrous. To suggest that families, especially Christian ones, could be idolatrous may strike you as a pretty harsh judgment. You may envision golden calves, fat clay statues, or scantily clad men and women dancing around a sacred yucca plant. But idolatry, as I've said earlier, simply means turning to a source other than God to meet your needs. Remember the can't win rule and grandma's bread stuffing? If telling grandma that you'd prefer not to eat her stuffing ruins her holiday and she feels like a less special human being, then the truth is she's getting a measure of her value and identity from her cooking and people's opinion of it. What a poor source of value. This is also a form of idolatry, because the true source of our worth and identity is God. If you help grandma to keep this false source of value at the expense of your honesty, then you actually encourage her to remain touchy and immature. You will continue to feel a lack of closeness towards her, and you will continue to dread going to her house. You're protecting, at the expense of your own integrity, not to mention your taste buds, an illusion of peace and closeness that doesn't really exist at all. This is not a relationship. It is an arrangement. True, there are kind and tactful ways of saying things, but don't mistake lying for being nice. Grandma really won't benefit from her family's tiptoeing around her false gods. She needs to know that she is loved and accepted, even when the stuffing doesn't turn out right. You can say, "No, thank you. I don't want any stuffing, but I love you, Grandma." How much more honest and graceful is that than to be dishonest to Grandma while looking for more and more nice excuses not to visit next time? 6, shame-based systems have a hard time with kids. Since the rules that govern these systems are mostly unspoken, it's almost impossible to live up to the standard. You never know where you stand. Needs, feelings, opinions, a certain behavior, and even the opposite behavior, everything has the potential to bring on a sense of shame, especially to kids. Everything must be perfect. So-and-so is coming. Watch what you say, because so-and-so gets upset easily. You must walk on eggshells. Take everything very seriously. Watch your P's and Q's. Toe the line. Get your ducks in a row and act your age, which means older than you are. Don't laugh too hard at jokes. Don't make too much noise or have too much fun while you're playing. Don't talk at the table and never, never run in church. It's not okay for kids to be kids in shame-based families or churches. They must be miniature adults. But healthy kids are constantly in the process of finding out what's real. It's the job of children to experiment with life. It's an imperfect, even messy process. Consequently, kids in a shame-based system get shamed a lot. 7, shame-based systems are preoccupied with fault and blame. People make choices. Some are wise, some are unwise. Some are right, others are wrong. It's okay to hold people responsible or accountable for their actions, but shame-based systems don't merely hold people accountable for their choices. They indict people on the basis of their behaviors. Fault and blame are the issues, not responsibility. Behaviors have an awful lot of power in these systems. too much power. This can be seen in the way a lapse in performance is handled. If someone else's performance or behavior, a choice, or an appearance, has the power to make a statement about me, I have to make sure that blame is concretely fixed on them in order to push that shame away from me. Let's say that a church invites a guest speaker to preach on a Sunday morning. Unfortunately, to everyone's dismay, the speaker uses some crude expressions and makes several statements that are out and out heresy. In a shame-based church, the follow-up to such an event would be this. The congregation would criticize and blame the pastor and elders for inviting the speaker. The pastor and elders would in turn assign specific blame to the person who recommended the speaker in order to prove to the congregation the mistake was not their fault. All this activity, rather than simply saying, "Sorry, folks, guess we'll never have that speaker here, back here." In short, shame-based systems burn up a lot of energy in self-defense and in asking, who's responsible? And the question isn't raised for the purpose of helping the guilty party face the consequences, much less so that the forgiveness can be extended. It is raised because we need to know whom we should shame or who should be made to feel bad. After all, if we can make people feel bad enough about their behaviors, they'll stop, right? Shame-based systems overreact to the choices of their members. You can never perform well enough, and you can never be sorry enough when you don't perform. When a mistake is made, people in this system never need to say they are sorry, whether they are sorry or not. But when they say they're sorry, they get the message, sorry isn't good enough. There is no way of doing it right, or of saying they're sorry, or of correcting the mistake. No way to escape being shamed. 8. Shame-based systems are strong on head skills. People in shame-based relationships live basically in a defensive mode. Shame hurts. It cuts to the heart. Therefore, people must become experts at self-defense techniques to protect themselves against shaming messages. These include denying the existence of problems or rationalizing them away, blaming others, and becoming a good debater. In shame-based systems, people are constantly interrogated. But the questions asked have no answers. Quote, "I just can't understand why you did that. Is your head on backwards?" Quote, "Whatever possessed you to say that?" Quote, "Why did you do that?" The only safe answer is, "I don't know." Any other answer would be analyzed and made to look foolish. 9. Shame-based systems are weak on heart skills. The only feelings allowed in a shame-based system are those which can be justified or understood. Emotions must be thought, not felt. If you can't explain the feeling, then it must not exist. Experiencing or expressing certain emotions, such as sadness, hurt, loneliness, or humiliation, is viewed as an indication of weakness or defectiveness. All efforts by members of the system to fix or change these feelings only shame a person for feeling that way and causing so much upset. People in shame-based relationships think that if they can understand why they feel the way they do, then the feeling will go away. Moreover, they believe that feelings should go away. Consequently, they get stuck carrying a lot of heavy emotions that they are never able to resolve. Compliments, compassion, and empathy are reserved for those outside the system. Janet's story illustrates this point. When Janet brought home friends, Her parents showed real interest in their hobbies, interests, grades, and accomplishments. Compliments flowed, but Janet's performance was criticized or ignored. Other times, her parents would brag about her to others, while she distinctly felt that the bragging was only to gain a sense of worth for themselves. She did the hard work, but never got the compliments. Her parents' rationale was, "We don't want you to get a big head." Well, it worked. Number 10, people in shame-based systems only look as if their needs are met. People come away from shame-based systems with a sense that they are not loved and accepted, not even lovable or acceptable, only loved and accepted if, when, or because they perform, not capable, valuable, or worthwhile, very alone, not really belonging anywhere, to anything, or with anyone. Finally, the shame-based family or church is a system that is upside down. A shame-based relationship system isn't there to pour strength and fullness into its members. Instead, it draws from its members in order to perpetuate itself. The members are so needy, however, that they are not capable of filling anyone else's needs. This leaves the members and the system still in need, and everyone indicted for failing. The shame and neediness in the system passes on to the members, to the future relational systems, and to subsequent generations. But since love and acceptance are something to be earned, members have learned to be good performers. They've had to. The result is the person I think David Siemens is talking about when he describes the super self, which is the empty and disconnected on the inside with the appearance of fullness on the outside. Quote from David Siemens' book, Healing Grace. The problem with shame, whether it's passed on in silence or with loud shouting, is that it's crippling. In fact, it's like a living death. You spend your life feeling as though you're not good enough, living according to performance, never measuring up, and always wondering when you're going to start living and being happy. The reason so many people feel, or the reason so many people do not feel fully alive, or that part of them is dead inside, is that they have not been fully awakened to life. But life is here, to be had and enjoyed freely. I want to show you now how you can choose not to listen to those killing voices, how to choose life.